Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. A recent conference on women in Irish sport in Louth County Museum saw a host of speakers highlight the experiences and involvement of women in a variety of sports, past and present. I'm joined now by two guests, both of whom presented their work at that conference. Hayley Kilgallen is with me here in studio. She's researched the emergence of the ladies' Gaelic football in the 1970s. And joining me from a studio in Belfast is Dr. Rachel Telford, lecturer in sports development at the School of Sport at Ulster University, who has researched female surfers. You're both very, very welcome indeed. Rachel, you found that there hasn't been a huge amount of research on surfing culture in general, I suppose, really, in Ireland, not just on female surfers, despite the fact that it's a sport that has grown in popularity in this country since the 1960s.
Absolutely. There's over 20,000 surfers in Ireland, which could be quite surprising to a lot of people because it's just not a visible sport to many. And certainly in terms of the research, the focus has been on men's sports, men's team sports, particularly soccer and Gaelic football. And the surfing research has just not been there because the focus has been on the national traditional sports. But I would anticipate that'll change now that surfing will be in the Olympic Games. And Ireland will be sending a team to Tokyo 2020 for the first time.
And when did it really begin to emerge? Because in the 1960s, I mean, we would have associated surfing with the Beach Boys in California, and it was far too cold to surf in Ireland.
Absolutely. And it was one of the key families in Bundoran, the Britons, who went, Eastkey Britain's grandmother, she went over to California. It was on a tourism visit. She owned a hotel in Bundoran and was keen to learn from California culture and tourism. And it was out there that she saw surfing for the first time and saw the waves and thought, it's better back in Bundoran and bus bring some of these boards back. It could really help us with tourism back home. But when she brought the boards back, it was her sons who took them out into the water, and the tourists, when they came to Bundoran, never actually got to see them. So they were very much a pioneering family in Bundoran when it came to bringing the surfing to Ireland in the 60s.
And again, the image that we have of surfing in the 60s and in the 70s was of bronzed gods, I suppose one or two goddesses, but mostly bronzed gods in California. That wouldn't have been practical in Ireland. So I imagine that it was the onset of the wetsuit that would have helped the development of the sport in Ireland in general, not just for women, but for men as well.
Oh, absolutely. And it was really towards the 90s when it really took off in Ireland, both for men and women. And you'll see more and more people even in the water in the past 10, 15 years as popularity has grown. But certainly we don't have the beach culture that they have, and it's still absolutely freezing and people are a bit mad to go out there in the water. But there isn't that culture. And I find that really interesting when it came to my research when I was looking at gender and women surfing. Because a lot of the time when you go out surfing, you have a full hood on, full wetsuit, and your body's fully covered. So when you're looking from the sand, you don't actually know if it's a male or female out in the water. So that raised some interesting questions, you know, when I was speaking to the women about how it interacted with their sense of self and their identity.
And I mean, pardon my ignorance, I know nothing about it as a sport, as a competitive sport, but is it a gendered sport? Are there men's competitions? Are there women's competitions? Are there any mixed competitions? Would they compete against each other, for example?
There's gender divisions, but I think, and it has been very gendered in the past, but certainly now that the Tokyo team are going out, like it's three men, three women, and it's very, very equal. And surfing as a sport in general is equal prize money when you go up to the higher levels. So it's, you know, followed suit in the likes of sports like tennis, which I think is really, really positive when it comes to men and women's participation and being seen as equals in the sport.
And how did you seek out female surfers, and what kind of thing did you or did they tell you about what the sport means to them, and perhaps about some of the disadvantages that they had to overcome?
Well, I had friends who surfed and they kind of pointed me in the right direction of key people like Eastkey Britain and other high level surfers in Ireland, pivotal women who had really kind of changed the face of surfing. Zoe Lally was one of them, who had started her work with the Irish Surfing Association back in 1995, and she's been really pivotal in the growth of women's surfing. So it was great to speak to those kind of pioneering women, but also their families, and really understand how surfing in those local communities around the coasts of Ireland was really part of their national identity and where they were from. But equally speaking to women from Northern Ireland and other parts of Ireland who maybe weren't from coastal towns, that they very much saw it as an escape from their national identity and some of the national sports that they've been involved with. And it was very much a freedom from all of that. So it was a real mix of experiences in terms of identity and national identity and why the women were surfing.
As it's a relatively new sport to this country, is it or has it been historically less gendered? Has there been less discrimination? Are there fewer advantages for women to have to overcome?
I think it has been very gendered when I was doing the research, but I think it leveled out, has started to level out a lot quicker than other sports. I think it's interesting maybe because it is out in the sea and it's not a spectator sport, and the communities that surf are very close-knit communities. There's a lot of support from the Irish Council, Sports Council, in terms of funding, like Women's Weekend specifically, and trying to get women out in the water, trying something new and something different. So my experience is where it has been gendered, but it very much is more equal playing field now.
Hayley, you've been researching the emergence of ladies' Gaelic football in the 60s and the 70s. Your paper was very interesting because it begins with a letter written in 1967, which was published in the Sunday Independent. And when you read it, certainly you read it now, it seems like it's more appropriate to 1967 BC. Tell us about this. Tell us about the letter, about a letter from a Cork farmer, which hopefully wasn't typical of 1967.
Well, it may have been typical as well. I think it gives an interesting insight into the place of women in Irish society at that time, but also in sport. So this farmer wrote to the Sunday Independent calling on the GAA to ban women from attending the upcoming All-Ireland finals. He said that women would take up valuable space in Croke Park. But he went a bit further, saying that the sight of women outside the home up in the city for fun and enjoyment was revolting and unnatural to him. But what's significant here, I think, is that all the responses that were published by the Sunday Independent a week later all argued against the farmer, and they came from men and women. They said that women were human beings, not mechanical instruments, and that if the GAA was a male-only organisation, as he said, then match attendances and gate receipts would be much lower. So I think it gives an interesting insight there into women's place in society at the time and the way society was reassessing the traditional role of women.
OK, I'm assuming that he was probably in his 60s or 70s when he wrote the letter, so he's probably turning in his grave at the moment. The title of your paper was From Novelty Act to National Association. And in the 60s, before the establishment of the Ladies Gaelic Football Association in 1973, 74, was that what Ladies Gaelic Football was, a novelty act?
Yes, we first start to see ladies' Gaelic football to appear at carnival tournaments in the late 60s, and it was advertised alongside traditional carnival activities like tug-of-war competitions and dances. And it was seen as an activity that would just bring in a bit of extra money, I think, to these carnivals. And at the same time, you start to see workplaces and county associations organise tournaments themselves, often for charity. In 1969, a tournament took place in Tipperary that between local businesses and offices that was a charity tournament. And the Offaly County Association included Ladies Gaelic Football on their county sports day in 73. And as a result of these festivals and other charity tournaments, there's evidence that by 1973, it was played in about 16 counties, or had been played at that time, but mainly on a small local scale.
And was the rise of the women's movement, which would have been in parallel with this, was that of any significance? I mean, obviously, you know, Betty Friedan wouldn't have given a toss about, you know, the All-Ireland or Gaelic football, but nonetheless, things were happening in Ireland. So was that part of it?
Yeah, I don't think you can ignore the fact that there was a strong women's movement at the time, and that definitely created pathways for women to get involved in public life more than they had previously. But in the research I did, I didn't find any motivation from the women who were playing Gaelic football to do so out of a feminist kind of agenda. They were just looking for an active social life outside of the home, and that was their main driving factor to play Gaelic football.
And then how does the formation of the association come about in 1973?
So in 1973, it was a real turning point for ladies' Gaelic football in that a inter-county match was organised between Offaly and Kerry. And in the absence of a national association, this was billed as the first All-Ireland final for ladies' Gaelic football. And it was organised by Brendan Martin of Offaly, who the cup today is named after. It attracted a good deal of media attention. It was a feature in both the Evening Herald and the Evening Press. But what was significant here was that the Offaly County Board supported this match, and they included it on their club fixture list for the 29th of July. So it exposed it to the wider Gaelic Games community as well. And the Evening Press, in their post-match report, noted that many people who came to jeer at the women playing Gaelic football left the ground in admiration. So I think it shows there as well how it was seen as a novelty act to many people who just came to see what the women were at.
Tell me about the 1977 final, because that certainly drummed up a lot of publicity, thanks to Sister Pauline.
Yes, so in 1977, Roscommon reached the All-Ireland final and they were to play Cavan. But prior to the All-Ireland semi-final, one of their players, Pauline Gibbons, left to take her vows as a nun in England. So ahead of the All-Ireland final, the Roscommon County Board wrote to her mother superior and asked for special permission for Pauline to play the final, which her mother superior gave her. And I believe Sister Pauline was nicknamed George Best in her convent. But unfortunately, despite the prayer said, Roscommon ended up as runners-up and Cavan were All-Ireland champions in 77.
Good old Cavan. And one of the headlines was big match prayers for Sister Pauline. I'd say there were a lot more headlines. But it wasn't until 1982 that the GAA officially recognises the LGFA.
Yeah, and delegates from the LGFA and the GAA did meet a number of times in the 70s, but it's unclear what came out of these meetings. And in 1982, Mick Fitzgerald, the LGFA president at the time, simply recalls being handed a scroll in the Gresham Hotel. So it seems like it was an unceremonious affair, but an important one nonetheless. It was a huge step in recognising and legitimising ladies' Gaelic football.
This has nothing to do with history, and this is obviously just a personal opinion. We're going to ask you anyway. Is it time to drop the L?
I think we're definitely seeing it in other sports. It's much more common now to see women's sports referred to as women's Gaelic football or women's soccer. But I'm not quite sure if it's there yet. Although, interestingly, the Irish version of ladies' Gaelic football is Cumann Pellgale na mBan, which is women's.
Yeah. things often sound better in Irish than they do in English. I presume you would welcome it, yes?
Exactly, definitely would.
Okay. Yes. Rachel, this kind of historical research, has it been neglected? Because obviously sports history is much more important and is far more widely studied in our universities now, for example, third level education, than it was before. Is this the study of women's sports, do you think it's going to enter the mainstream?
Absolutely, and I think it's definitely needed, because if we're going to celebrate women's, you know, achievements in sport, they need to be chronicled. You know, we need to have those records in place so that we can trace that back for future generations and they can see all the amazing things women have done in sport. Just because they're not visible there in the media doesn't mean that they haven't achieved those things. So I think it's really important that academics and people in their local communities, you know, record all the amazing things that women have done in sport.
Well, thank you both very much indeed for joining us this evening. We're going to have to leave it there, Hayley Gilgallon and Rachel Telford. My thanks also tonight to Tommy O'Sullivan on sound and our researcher Liz Gillis. Our reader tonight was Fiona Lucia McGarry. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE Radio. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye.